Okay, oh sorry, I have the copies, I forgot. I'm still working on the Megillah, so we're up to chapter 3 today. We can pass around copies. There's not enough we can share. Okay, so we are now up to chapter 3 in the Megillah. Chapter 2 ended that Esther was chosen as queen, and that's basically what happened in chapter 2. This is the rest of being chosen as queen. So now chapter 3 is where all the action seems to start to begin. In chapter 3, verse 1, it says, After these things, the king Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hamdasa, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. So this is when Haman is promoted. Until this point, Haman was just one of the advisors to the king. At this point, the king decided to promote him to second in command, basically.
Why, did he do something?
I'm not aware of what he did. I'm not sure. It's a good question. I'm not sure why he got promoted at this point, but he promoted him at this point. I do want to discuss, I mentioned this, I guess, in passing, maybe last week or 2 weeks ago, but I want to discuss more in depth now Haman's roots. It says Haman is the Agagite. He came from Agag. Agag was the king of the nation of Amalek, and at the times of King Saul, he was supposed to destroy and eradicate the entire nation, men, women, children, animals, everything. He let the king live, and he let some of the animals live. And Hashem was not happy with King Saul. And this was the move which actually made him lose his dynasty. After that point, it's passed on to King David and to the Davidic dynasty, which we have until nowadays. But that's who Agag was. Agag hails from the nation of Amalek. And Haman, therefore, as a descendant of Agag, comes from Amalek. The nation of Amalek, I'm going to give us a brief introduction to Amalek, because really the story of Purim surrounds the struggle between the Jewish people and Amalek, and it dates way back before the Purim story where the struggle began. So just to give a brief introduction to Amalek and what they represent, the nation of Amalek, Amalek was a human being, first and foremost. He was a grandson of Esav. So he actually is a cousin of the Jews. He's related to Esav, who was the son of Yitzchak. So he's one of our cousins. And that's Amalek as the human being. But Amalek also is the founder of a nation. And the nation of Amalek is viewed as, it's called the personification of evil in this world. In terms of people, in terms of nations, of all nations, every nation in the world has a redeeming quality to them. So even though there are nations out there which may seem immoral, unethical, anti-Semitic, whatever you want to say, but bottom line, every single nation you could find some aspect of goodness. There's something to learn from them, something that they could use to channel towards goodness and towards a morality. Amalek we view as the one nation with no redeeming qualities. It's a nation which totally stands for evil, totally stands up against God and God's will in the world. They come to cut down anything of significance. They come to ridicule and to deride and downgrade anything of importance. That's how we view Amalek. The words, the Hebrew, the letters, Ayin, Mem, Lamed, Kuf. So you can rearrange those letters to stand for Kal, a insignificant nation. Kal meaning means light or insignificant. Insignificant nation. Those are those letters. And there's some famous numerical values, gematrias, which we say about Amalek. Amalek numerically in gematria is 240, which is the same gematria, same numerical value as the word Suffolk, meaning doubt. Because the nation which puts into the world the doubt of God, that force, is Amalek. So again, Amalek is the physical nation, which at this point we don't know who descends from that nation. Genealogically, we're not sure anymore who comes from Amalek, so that's not relevant to us. What's relevant to us, there's a force in the world. That force still exists in the world. And that force is viewed as the force which creates doubts in our minds about God, about God's guidance and providence in the world. That's the force called Amalek. Amalek 240 is the same as a Suffolk. The math right? 240. You got it. Right, 240. And there's another gematria, another numerical value of Amalek, which is El Acher, another god, a strange god. Because Amalek gives us the false perception of other powers in the world. That force called Amalek, they represent that there are other powers other than God. The truth is, the only power in the world is God. Everything comes from God. Everything is under God's control. Anything happens because God wants it to happen. Amalek is that force which makes us think, no, there is an El Acher. There are other powers. There's other possibilities. There's options. It may not be God. Maybe it's... So it dates back, you could say, to idolatry, pagan religions. It could be another god. Even in our own modern lives, it could be me. It could be my boss. It could be the president. It could be my congressman. It could be anybody. We contribute power to forces other than God in the world. When really Torah teaches this bottom line, everything stems from God. All power is God's power. Anything which occurs is under God's watch. And that's that. Amalek, though, brings up that doubt, brings up that possibility that there is other forces out there besides God. Amalek first encountered the Jews on their way to Mount Sinai. We just left Egypt. There's been 7 weeks between leaving Egypt and receiving the Torah on Mount Sinai. There were 7 weeks. During the 7 week period, Amalek attacked. At that point in history, the Jews had just experienced tremendous miracles of the Exodus, the 10 plagues. They had seen the splitting of the sea. And the whole world held the Jews in very high esteem. They thought we were untouchable. God really protects these people. The first nation to come and try to attack was Amalek. And they showed that, you know, don't think that Jews are invincible. There are ways you can get to the Jews. They're the first ones to come and step in and try to do that. So on the one hand, they showed other nations that the Jews aren't invincible. There are times where God may leave us to natural forces, such as if we're not following God's will. And they also tried to cut us off from receiving the Torah. We were on our way to Mount Sinai. We just left Egypt, on our way to Mount Sinai. They jump in and say, we cannot stand for a nation receiving God's Torah. We don't want that to happen. And philosophically, we understand Amalek as the nation which tries to cut us off from the Torah. They're saying, we don't want Jews to worship God. We don't want to see God in the world. We don't want to have God as a power. And that's what Amalek comes to represent. The Torah says that Nechama L'Hashem B'Amalek Midor Dor means that for every generation, Hashem, in a sense, has a battle against Amalek. Now, obviously, we don't believe in two forces. Amalek is a creation of Hashem as well. But the way it's perceived is that we have a struggle. There's God and there's other things. There's good, there's evil. We perceive it as a struggle. Ultimately, it's all from God. Amalek was created by God. Even evil is created by God. It's all from God. That's the Jewish philosophy. Everything comes from God. But the perception is that there's two forces which have to fight and struggle. And that's what Amalek represents, that force of evil in the world. The Torah tells us, it's the prophecy actually stated by Bilam, the non-Jewish prophet in the Torah. He says that Amalek is achariso adei oved, that eventually Amalek will be eradicated. Meaning that every other nation has its place in God's world. We have nothing against non-Jewish nations. Everyone has something to offer. Everyone has something which they can positively contribute to the world, besides Amalek. Amalek at the end, in the final days, there's no way to rectify Amalek's evil. Their evil has no place, there's no redeeming qualities, and their destiny is destruction. Everyone else has their place. Every single other nation has something to offer, has something positive which we can learn from and gain from, but not Amalek. That's how we view them. So to take it a step further, we have a mitzvah, which we'll read about this Shabbos. The mitzvah is to destroy Amalek. Usually we view murder as a terrible, terrible, terrible thing, but the one place with the Torah, was actually one other place, but one unique place where the Torah does say there's a mitzvah to eradicate a nation is only Amalek. This nation, we have a mitzvah to eradicate. So King Saul was given that charge, the first king of the Jews, first king of Israel. He failed. He allowed them to live on. And to this very day, that force still exists in the world. So we don't know who they are, so obviously we can't go out and start killing, God forbid. But that mitzvah is a mitzvah from the Torah incumbent upon every Jew to eradicate the nation of Amalek. So every Shabbos prior to Purim, we read Parsha Zachar, which we read the Shabbos in Shul, which is the mitzvah to remember the evil of Amalek, and to remind us that we have a mitzvah of eradicating Amalek. That's what Parsha does. So that's the Parsha which we read the Shabbos in Shul. But it all circles around the Purim story, because Purim is the next, I guess the final time you find in Tanakh with Amalek coming up against the Jews. Haman, as the descendant of Amalek, he again rises up to eradicate the Jewish people. And Purim is a struggle of Amalek versus the Jewish people, and we come out on top in the story of Purim. We don't eliminate Amalek from the world, but at least we come out on top in this story over here. So Haman, who stems from Agag, that's why the Megillah gives us his lineage, tells us he's the Agagite, because he descends from Amalek, and therefore part of the underlying hatred of Haman towards the Jews is an innate hatred from his ancestors. There's an innate the disgust that Amalek has with Jewish people being people of God, and therefore he comes to eradicate us once again. So that's the story of Amalek and where Haman comes from. So again, nowadays we don't know who stems from Amalek, but to recognize that there is a force in the world, though there are forces in the world that do draw us away from God, create those doubts, create options in our minds that there's powers here other than God. God's not in control. That comes from this source called the Malik. That's where it all comes from. So that's the first verse in chapter 3, and Haman, who descends from Malik, is promoted. In verse 2, and all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed down and prostrated themselves before Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordechai bowed not down, nor prostrated himself before him. So King Achashverosh had said that everyone should bow down to Haman. So he promoted him, he made him second in command, and gave him all the glory and all the power he could possibly give him. Mordechai refused. So why did Mordechai refuse is an interesting discussion. Because technically, a Jew is allowed to bow down out of respect for a king. We're not allowed to bow down to a deity. We can't bow down to an idol, to other religions, other gods. But to give respect to a king, I mean, you even find throughout the Tanakh that they bowed down before the Jewish king. People came into King David and bowed down before him. So it's okay to bow down to show respect to a human being. The problem is the rabbis tell us one of two things. Either that Haman made himself into a deity. He actually deified himself. He walked around claiming that he was some sort of god. That was one issue. The other issue is the rabbis tell us Haman used to wear an idol around his neck. So bowing down to Haman was also bowing down to that idol. And therefore Mordechai, as a Jew and a Jew who would not compromise his values in any way, shape, or form, would not bow down, would not prostrate himself before Haman. So then, in verse 3, then the king's servant the king's servants that were in the king's gate said unto Mordechai, Why transgressest thou? Why do you have to transgress the king's commandment? So everyone said to Mordechai, why aren't you listening? What's the big deal? And even the Jews told him this. Even the other Jews around, at this point, Mordechai was sticking to his values. And all the other Jews, it sounds like Mordechai was the exception. Everyone else is bowing down to Haman. And they all said, Mordechai, you're getting us in trouble. What do you think you're doing? And he did get them in trouble, it seems, because Haman is going to decree to kill the Jews based on Mordechai's behavior. But everyone said to Mordechai, what do you think you're doing? Why don't you listen to the king? Why don't you bow down? Verse 4, now it came to pass, and they spoke daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them. So every single day, Mordechai had pressure. Bow down to Haman. If you can imagine the pressure, day after day after day, everyone around you saying, listen to the king. Why don't you bow down to Haman? And Mordechai still would not give in. And he hearkened not unto them. And they told Haman to see whether Mordechai's word would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. So eventually word got back to Haman about this. At first he didn't notice. At first, you know, there were probably thousands of people around bowing down to him. He didn't notice that one Jew in the corner not bowing down. But word got back to him about Mordechai, and Haman became concerned. The wording used... Where is that? Actually, it's later on. Actually, the wording was before. The wording used in verse 2. I skipped a point. The wording is in verse 2, the very end of verse 2. So in Hebrew it says, Mordechai lo yichra lo yishtachaveh. That's future tense. It doesn't say Mordechai did not bow and did not prostrate. It says he would not bow, would not prostrate. So that's telling you a historical account that in those times Mordechai didn't do it. It's telling us that Mordechai would not. It was out of his scheme of thinking. He would never even dream of doing it. He refused. That's how steadfast he was. Clinging to this tradition. So the Torah words it, the Megillah words it in future tense, that he will not do such a thing. Not that he didn't, but he would not. It wasn't anywhere, he had no dreams of doing it. So now we get to verse 5. In verse 5, now Haman's aware that Mordechai wouldn't bow down to him. When Haman saw that Mordechai bowed not down, nor prostrated himself before him, then was Haman full of wrath. So I always look at this verse, and you think about how unstable, psychologically, how was Haman? He was promoted to be the second in control of the entire empire. He had thousands bowing down to him. One Jew in the corner would not bow down, and he couldn't tolerate it. It seems like he was someone who lacked a lot of self-confidence. He was crazy in a sense. This Jew got on his nerves so much that he's about to commit genocide because of it. Most people would say, okay, I have tens of thousands of people bowing down to me. One guy, what am I going to do? So I'll put him in prison or something. But why would it get on my nerves so much? But Haman... He was somebody who, either he was so power hungry, or so arrogant he couldn't tolerate it, or he was so unstable and lacked so much self-confidence he couldn't tolerate it. One of the two. But you see something about Haman's character, as being a person who, he didn't look at the positive things occurring to him, he only looked at that one guy in the corner who wouldn't do it. Which is a very unhealthy attitude overall for a person to have, to only view the negative, not the positive. Especially when so much positive was happening in his life. Why would he get bothered by that one Jew in the corner? But it bothered him so much, he's full of wrath. Yes?
Was Mordecai the leader of the Jews? Somehow the leader of the Jews? Maybe he wasn't in the corner, and maybe because...
He stood out as the leader of the Jews.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Mordecai was a leader of the Jews. The rest of the Jews did bow down to Haman, though. So, but I guess as a leader, Haman felt threatened. That's a good point. That could be. He felt threatened because he was the leader. Which really ties into the next verse, so that's a good point. He says in verse 6, "But it seemed contemptible in his eyes to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had made known to him that the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Achashverosh, even the people of Mordecai." Well, it implies that initially he wasn't aware Mordecai was Jewish, and at this point he found out, in verse 6. It does seem that way. But on the other hand, once Haman found out that Mordecai was Jewish, he said, "I can't just lay my hands on Mordecai, I have to lay my hands on his entire people." So the Vilna Gaon explains here, why would he make such a conclusion? I mean, it's one person, everyone else was being obedient, everyone else was listening to the king's rule, everyone else was bowing down to Haman. Mordecai was the one exception. Why did he say, "Well, I can't stand for Mordecai's people"? So the Vilna Gaon explains, because once he found out that Mordecai was doing it based on religious reasons, he said that religion has to go. That's what he said. If he thought Mordecai was just some guy in the crowd who was being rebellious, that's one thing. But Mordecai does it based on his own morals, his own religious values.
Haman at this point does not know that Queen Esther is attached to
Mordecai. Right. Well, they might know he's attached, but they don't know if she's Jewish. So it sounds like everyone knows they're attached. They know that Mordecai raised her.
At this point, they know.
Yeah. Okay. But nobody knows that she's Jewish, though, because she was an orphan. So okay. It could be they just took her in from the street. They don't know her story. But so the Vilna Gaon explains that it's because it stemmed from religious beliefs, that's why Haman wanted to annihilate the entire people. And the Vilna Gaon says that ultimately you see it nowadays, the worst type of hatred is religious hatred. People who have, you know, political differences, that gets pretty bad. People with religious differences, that's life and death. I mean, we see it throughout history, we see it nowadays. So when Haman saw it's his religion which is standing in my way, that's it, I can't deal with it. They have to be wiped off the face of the planet. That's what he said. So that was Haman's attitude towards Mordecai. I want to point out one other word here. In the very beginning of verse 6, so in English they translate it as contemptible. In Hebrew it says vayivez. Vayivez is a term which means, I'd say, shameful. Or it would be ridiculous or shameful. It would have been shameful in his eyes just to kill Mordecai. But the term in Hebrew for ve'ivez, nevaze, that term also means to embarrass, or to, I'm trying to get a good term in English, to...
lower himself.
What?
Lower himself.
Not lower himself, it's more, it was a, it's, let's say... I go through translation sometimes. I guess the word would be, I mean, it's a type of cynicism, a type of, you know, ridiculing something else, downgrading something else. That's the word, mevaze in Hebrew. That word means to ridicule or to downgrade or to be cynical towards something. So Haman, they point out, he descends from Esav, because Amalek was the grandson of Esav. Esav used the same term in the Torah. The Torah says when it comes to Esav, Esav sold the birthright to Yaakov. And it says, Vayivez Esav Esav Bechora. Esav ridiculed. The same exact word, Vayivez. He ridiculed. He downgraded. He was cynical towards the birthright. And the rabbis connect both of those characters in Torah, that both of them had these attitudes that think, like we said before, things of significance, things of importance, things that were godly or moral in the world, they just ridiculed. They were cynics. They couldn't stand for things that were significant in life. That's the idea of Vayivez. So they had the same attitude. And there are people out there we know. Some people, whenever anything of importance happens, they say a little wisecrack. They cut it down to size. Some people actually are able to see things that are important and to admire and appreciate what's happening. Others see something important and they make a cute wisecrack and they push it out of their system. So the attitude of Esav and Amalek is that they can't stand for things of importance. Immediately, as soon as something important happens, they just kind of brush it off and they ridicule it and they downgrade it and they're cynical towards it. Our value is the opposite. Our value is to understand what's important and to appreciate it and to use it and to praise it. That's our value. Verse 7, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Achashverosh, they cast Pur. That is the lot, before Haman, from day to day, and from month to month, to the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So we're right now in the month of Nisan, in the story. Adar is the 12 months away, because Nisan comes after Adar. So it's extremes on the calendar. So Haman decided to cast a lot. He wanted to make a lottery to figure out what's the best day to kill the Jews. That's what he did. And it turned out that the best day, according to his lottery, was the month of Adar, 12 months away. And it would be on the 13th of Adar is the date which he decided on, 13th of Adar.
Why did he
wait so long? That's a good question. Well, I guess the bigger question would be, why did he put up to a lottery? Why didn't he just say, let's do it right now?
Yeah.
Right? Let's just do it right now. So, I'm not 100% sure of the answer to that, why he chose to do a lottery. But there's a message you definitely see here. When you think about what's a lottery, what does a lottery mean to us? A lottery is something which is random. You think you pull out the ball, whatever it is, it's a random selection. Amalek is the nation in the world, we said before, they stand for doubt. Doubt means that there's nothing, the hand of God doesn't function in this world. Everything is just random, it's happenstance, things just kind of occur. There's no one guiding it all. A lottery is no one's guiding it. If you guide a lottery, then you're cheating. There's no one guiding a lottery. The idea of a lottery is you leave things up to chance, to happenstance. There's no intelligence involved. There's no divine providence. So Haman was using his tool of chance, his lottery, which is totally devoid of any sort of intelligence, devoid of God, in order to decide when to kill the Jews. Why he chose the lottery, I'm not really sure. But what's symbolic of this lottery is that the lottery means chance. That's what it means. Because Amalek believes the world is left to chance, left to happenstance, not left to God. That's what Amalek means. That's what Amalek believes. What's interesting is that we call the holiday Purim. That's that the poor is the lottery. We call it lotteries. That's the English translation of Purim is lotteries, which is a very strange translation. Why do we call the holiday lotteries? But it's really the point. The message of Purim. Purim teaches us that even things that we think are chance are also directed by God. Like we discussed at the very beginning of learning the Megillah itself seems to be just a chain of random events. That's what the Megillah looks like in our eyes. But at the end of the Megillah, you find out that all those events are actually guided by God. That's what it's all about. A lottery appears to be random, but we have to understand that even things that appear like happenstance, things that appear like they're just by chance, it's also God. So the message of Purim is in the lottery. The fact that the lottery, which appears like chance, is also God's will, that's the message of the whole holiday. The things, even events in life, events in history, events which happen on a daily basis, which seem to just kind of happen, seem to be natural, seem to be happenstance, they're all coming from God. That's the message. So Haman thought, so I'm going to do something totally devoid of intelligence, I'm going to do something totally random, totally a chance. But yet, we'll see that even God was involved in the day he pulled out. The day he pulled out was 12 months away. It's like you were asking, why did he wait so long? So why he chose the lottery, I'm not sure. The lottery told him to wait for 12 months. But the 12 months gave the Jews time to prepare, to repent, to prepare to fight. It gave them a lot of time in order to overturn Haman's decree. So if Haman had pulled out, let's kill the Jews tomorrow, then it could have been a different story. But because Haman pulled out, let's kill the Jews in 12 months, that gave us a lot of time to get ready for the big day.
They did fight
at the end. We'll see in the story, but after Achashverosh couldn't repeal the decree, because anything which was sealed with the king's ring could not be repealed. That was the law. But what he did was that he said the Jews should fight back and offered his support for the Jews to fight back. The Jews did fight back. There was a battle.
Is it before or after Haman was hanged?
After he was hanged. There's still a battle. Because all the anti-Semites and all the Amalekites out there wanted to still kill the Jews. So they had the king's support. But ultimately, there was a battle and they won the battle. But it gave them time to repent so that God would be on their side and to prepare militarily so they could actually fight. And 12 months later, they're ready to fight and they won. That's what happened. So you find the hand of the God even within Haman's lottery. So it appeared like chance, but it was actually God. And again, that's the message we should take out of it, of Purim overall. Even things that appear like just chance circumstances are really God behind the scenes. That's what it all is. In verse 8 it says, so that now Haman has a day that he wants to designate to kill the Jews, and he goes to Achashverosh. And Haman said unto King Achashverosh, there are certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from those of every people, neither keep they the king's laws, therefore it profiteth not the king to suffer them. Let's put that in English. So Haman tells Achashverosh, There's people who are scattered about, they're dispersed, they have different rules than everyone else. We have to follow the Torah law. They don't follow the king's laws. Therefore, the king has no benefit to keeping them around. That's what he tells them. So he's trying to persuade Ahasuerush to kill this nation. We discussed way back in the beginning of the Megillah that there's a dual meaning when we talk about the king. The king means Ahasuerush, and the king means the king of all kings. The king also means God. So here...
I'm sorry, what's the first one?
King could mean Ahasuerush, the human king, but also could mean God, the king of all kings. You have a dual meaning when you see the word the king in the Megillah. Because again, the Megillah is supposed to be the expression of God behind the scenes. So God is acting through human means. Therefore, the king that we see as a king of people is actually God using him as a tool to bring his will into the world. So it's a double meaning. It's a midrash. It's based on a Zohar. It says that there's a double meaning to the word the king in the Megillah, both King Ahasuerus and the king of all kings and God. So when Haman is convincing Ahasuerus to decree against the Jews, on a deeper level, he's also convincing God to decree against the Jews. So the Gemara actually takes this, and the commentaries discuss it on two different levels. So the Gemara talks about on one level, Haman is trying to persuade Ahasuerus to kill the Jews. So if you go back into the verse, so he says there's a certain people scattered abroad. The Hebrew word for there is, yeshno, is the same letters as yashnu, they're sleeping. So the dual meaning here, Haman speaks to Ahasuerus and says, there's people out there, the Jewish people, who I'd like to annihilate. The Ahasuerus says, well, I'm scared of their God. I know that they've experienced miracles in the past. I'm scared of their God. How can we do such a thing? So he says, yeshno, they're sleeping. They've fallen asleep from serving God. They're not doing God's mitzvahs. So don't worry about their God. God's not on their side anymore. So then it continues and it says that Ahasuerus says to Haman, well, what about, there's still rabbis out there. And even though the people may not be following God's will, they still have their scholars, their leaders, their rabbis who are following God's will. So he says that, and you lose it in the English, but Hebrew is Am Echad. They're one nation. Yeshno Am Echad, one nation. So just because there might be some nice rabbis out there, if the people aren't following God, then the rabbis aren't going to help them. So Haman says, Ahasuerus, don't be scared of their God. They're all one people. They're one unit. And since most of them are not following God's will, then God's not going to help them. So then Ahasuerus says to Haman, and we're filling in the blanks here, he says, well, you're going to leave major gaps in my kingdom. If I kill out all the Jewish neighborhoods, so what's going to happen to those neighborhoods? It's not good for kingdom to have these empty areas. So he says, don't worry, mefuzar mefurad. They're scattered. They're not concentrated in one spot. So they're scattered about. So you take off a Jew here and a Jew there. So you're not going to find an open area in your kingdom which will be vulnerable to enemies or anything like that. So don't worry about that. So then Ahasuerus says, well, maybe I benefit from them. Maybe they pay me taxes. Maybe they produce. There's some good scientists out there. Maybe there's something I can gain from the Jews. So he says the word mefurad. So mefurad literally means that they're dispersed. But it's made up of the same letters as preda, which means a mule. A mule is sterile. It doesn't produce. So Haman tells Ahasuerus, don't worry, they don't produce anything. They're worthless. They don't think that you gain so much of them because they're like mules. They don't produce anything. So then, and then Haman moves on to tell them that they don't follow, they don't follow the rules of the king. And he tells the king, they're always saying they can't go to work. Today's Shabbos, today's Pesach, today's Shavuos. They're never working. They always have a holiday to take off, all these days. That's what Haman tells Ahasuerus. So at that point, he's convincing Ahasuerus, it's not worth your while to keep them around, let's annihilate them. So on a deep, that's all the conversation of Haman Ahasuerus. So he's trying to convince this human king to agree to make a decree to annihilate the Jews. But on a deeper level, he has to convince God as well, because no decree in this world holds water without God being behind it. So the Gemara tells us, and you can take it on a deeper bit, you can take it on a deeper level, that the first point is the same point, that they're asleep from mitzvahs. You know, God, why are you leaving the Jews around? They're not following your will. They're sleeping. They're not alert. They're not doing your will. The fact that we are scattered and dispersed is refused the lack of Jewish unity. We're a fractured people. There's no brotherhood. There's no unity. There's fights. There's bickering, which unfortunately we also experience nowadays. But that's the reason that Haman would use towards God, to have God agree to annihilate the Jews. When it says that they don't follow the king's laws, so the king, again, has two levels to it. There's the earthly king, and there's the king of all kings. There's God. So he's saying, God, they don't follow your laws. So therefore, it's not profitable for you to keep them around if not doing their purpose. If the purpose of the Jewish people is to follow your will, fulfill the Torah, and bring out the godliness into the world, the holiness into the world, they're not doing that, so why are you leaving them around? What's your benefit you have out of it? So again, I don't know if Haman was consciously speaking with God. Probably he wasn't. But at least on a deeper level, in terms of the words of the Megillah, you find that these are arguments which would be directed towards God as well, that he should agree to Haman's decree, in addition to Achashverosh should be in Haman's decree. So you take it all on two levels. And it's a lesson for reading the whole Megillah. Every time you talk about the king and the Megillah, it works on two levels, which we pointed out before. So that's how you take this verse 8, on two levels. In verse 9, if it please the king, let it be written that they be destroyed. I'll pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those that have the charge of the king's business to bring it into the king's treasuries. So he's going to bribe the king, basically. I'm going to pay you a lot of money and agree to this decree. Now the Vilna Gaon points out that it clearly wasn't a bribe. But clearly what he was trying to do was fill the gap in taxes. That if you kill all these Jews, he was a lot of taxes. So Haman was trying to say, don't worry about your tax money, I'm going to cover it. So that's how the Vilna Gaon understands it. But he says that if you would decree to destroy the Jews, I'll make sure that your treasure houses are filled up with money. So in verse 10, and the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hamdasa, the Agagite, the Jews' enemy. In verse 11, and the king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee, people also, to do with them as it seems good to thee. So he gave him full permission, do what you want with the Jewish people, take your money back. He didn't want the money. He says, I don't need your money, do what you want. And the Gemara tells us that the truth is Achashverosh was as much of an anti-Semite as Haman was. He wanted to kill the Jews as much as Haman did. The Gemara gives us an analogy. They say, let's say there's somebody who has a big mound of dirt in his yard, and somebody else has a big hole in his yard. So the guy at the hole would go out and pay for some dirt to fill his hole. And the guy with the dirt would love for somebody to schlep away all of his dirt. And he's willing to pay money for that. So the two guys meet, they make a deal, so I'm not going to take your money, you just take my dirt, and we're set. So that's Haman and Achashverosh. They both hated the Jews, they both wanted them off the map. So the Achashverosh says, I don't need your money, take your money back, let's get rid of those Jews for me. And he was very happy with it. Which is also part of the miracle, because the fact that Achashverosh himself was anti-Semitical, and he did want to annihilate the Jews, even so at the end of the Megillah, he reversed the decree. That sounds miraculous. That's part of the miracle of Purim, the hidden hand of God, that even the king's emotions and his views towards the Jews could be flipped in such a dramatic manner. Because he himself was anti-Semitic his entire life. Even before, you can find other places in Tanakh that he was the one who stopped the construction of the second Beis HaMikdash. The Jews had started building the second temple in the times of the previous emperor, in the times of Cyrus. And Achashverosh took charge. He stopped the construction of the temple, because he didn't want the Jews to go back to Israel. He didn't like the Jews. After this story, so then Achashverosh's son was the one who actually allowed the temple to be rebuilt. He let them complete the construction. The Achashverosh himself wasn't anti-Semite just as much as Haman, and even though at the end of the story he turned against Haman and saved the Jews, that was all the miraculous hand of God orchestrating the events, because if not for that, Achashverosh would be very happy to see the Jews annihilated. In verse 10, you have an interesting point, which is Haman, the king took his ring from his hand and gave it to Haman. So the king's signet ring, that contained all the power. The king's stamp would be on any decree Haman made. And the Gemara has a phrase. The Gemara says that the removal of the ring of Achashverosh given to Haman was greater than the prophecies of all 48 prophets, male prophets, and seven female prophets that ever existed. Basically, the Gemara is saying that all the prophets which existed in Jewish history, they tried so hard to tell us to repent, to come back to God, and it didn't really work. When Achashverosh gave his ring to Haman, the Jews had a national repentance. They nationally returned to God, which we'll see in the rest of the Megillah. They all returned to God, they repented, they fasted, and reversed the decree. So the Gemara compares, and really contrasts, this decree of Achashverosh and Haman to all the prophets. What's the comparison? And the way that it's described by Rav Shlomo Wolbe, who was one of the great scholars in Israel, who just passed away a few years back. He said that, what's the difference? When a prophet comes and gives you a message, it's intellectual. You know, they can talk, they can give you a nice speech, hits you in the intellect, but doesn't necessarily hit you on a very tangible, physical plane. When you see an anti-Semite with the king's carte blanche permission to do what he wants with the Jews, that's real to you. That's tangible. And that really hits you. And so and the prophets, you know, they can write and they can speak and they can do anything they can, but it's only hearsay. It's not, you know, it's not tangible, it's not concrete. When you see Haman receiving the ring of Achashverosh, that's concrete, that's real, it's tangible, and that really, really knocks you into place. And it's an important lesson in life, which is that there's a difference between somebody who has belief in God intellectually and somebody who has it emotionally. Things that we see in the physical world, they really, really impact us. Things that we might know intellectually and believe, but we can't sense and see physically, doesn't hit us in the same way. And it's like, I think I may have said this analogy before. It's like somebody, you know, you could talk to a smoker and say smoking is bad for your health. You could show them all the statistics. You can have a doctor talk to them, and it won't work. As soon as, God forbid, they have, you know, a relative die from lung cancer, so that changes the ballgame. Because now it's real to them. Now it really hits home. That's the same idea. So when you have the prophets speak and speak and speak in the name of God, and even though intellectually you hear it and it makes sense to you, it may not change your life. But when you see something in actuality and you feel you see it physically, that impacts us. So really our goal as Jews is to work to the point where we sense God on a much more real plane. Right now we might understand God on an intellectual basis, through faith, through understanding. But to get to a point where we actually feel God in our lives and see God as a reality in the world in a much, much more tangible sense, that really impacts who we are. So the Gemara tells us, seeing that ring on Haman's hand, that shook us up. Because you see Haman, that's a real wake-up call. From Molech, Terwet HaSemite, ready to destroy the Jews, commit genocide, that really shakes us up. But having a prophet speak to you doesn't shake you up in the same way.
Is it possible, that the king was trying to remove himself from the annihilation of the Jews? Because if he turns over his ring, which represents the king...
Yeah. So you can say, it's not my fault.
Yeah. Is that a possibility?
I guess it's possible, but he wasn't really held accountable because he was an emperor with absolute power. So I'm not sure if he was worried about being held accountable by anybody. Yeah.
Okay.
Who was holding him accountable? There was no one out there.
Okay. Thank you.
So let's go into verse 12. So then were the king's scribes called in the first month on the 13th day thereof. So this is the 13th of Nisan. Just to picture the scene, this is the day before Erev Pesach. Because people don't think about it. The Purim miracle has actually occurred, a part of it occurred on Pesach itself. Haman was killed on Pesach. There are some Jews who have a custom to have a special meal during Pesach on the day of Haman's death, on his Yortzeit, because to celebrate of the miracle of Haman's death. Because this is the 13th of Nisan, is when these scribes are sending, when they're sending out all these letters to the nation, to all the different provinces. Esther goes into Achashverosh on Pesach. The decree is reversed on Pesach, and Haman is killed on Pesach. So it's a very interesting connection between Purim and Pesach that we see here. So let's keep reading. It says, it's the 13th of Nisan, and there is written according to all that Haman commanded unto the king's satraps, because that's his servants, and to the governors that were over every province, and to the princes of every people, to every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language. In the name of the king Achashverosh was it written, and it was sealed with the king's ring. So basically they sent out letters announcing this plan to all of the governors of the provinces. And letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey, taking all the property for spoils. So that was the letter that was sent. In verse 14, the copy of the writing to be given out for a decree in every province was to be published unto all peoples, so they should be ready for that day. So the commentaries explain, there's two things sent out here. There was full letters, and there was something in the Hebrew called pas shegen haksav, which the commentaries explain to mean it was like an outline or a summary of the letter. And the way that, well, I know two commentaries, both the Vilna Gaon and the Malbim, two great commentaries in the Megillah explain it, is that they didn't want everybody to know about the decree, because the Jews had some friends out there. And they didn't want anybody to warn the Jews, to help defend the Jews. So they kept it very hush-hush. What he sent out was very intelligent. He sent out to the governors the actual plan that we're going to kill the Jews. And he sent out the Pashegen Aksav, the summary. And all it said in the summary was to be prepared for that day. He told, so all the the lay folks in the nation, they're told, get ready for that day. That day is going to be an exciting day here in Persia. That's all they knew. They didn't know what was going to happen that day. The governors were very well aware of the decree. That's how many commentators explain this. So there's two things sent out. There was the letter sent to the governors, and there was just the summary or the outline, this one-liner, be prepared for the 13th of Adar, that was sent to everybody else. The posts went forth in haste by the king's commandment, and the decree was given out in Shushan the castle. So they rushed it out, and rushing it out itself allowed more time for the Jews to prepare. So the fact it was rushed out. So even though it wasn't be for 12 months away, the letters got rushed out for some reason. But it gave the Jews just that, even that extra time to get ready for what was going to happen. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. So there's two points I would like to make here to finish up the chapter. The fact that Shushan was perplexed, so the commentators explain that's because of this letter. The letter which said, just get ready. Well, that's kind of confusing. We don't know what we're getting ready for, but we got ready.
That was
perplexing. So they're perplexed. But what happened? The king and Haman sat down to drink. It's a fascinating thing. So they basically just declared genocide. And they're sitting down to have dinner together. And it's when you think about people who are so wicked, so evil, it doesn't even, they're so numb and desensitized to what it means to murder somebody. It didn't even stop them in their normal daily routine. Okay, we'll kill the Jews, let's have a drink. That's what they did. And there's a Rabbi Manuel Feldman has a book, Tales Out of Jerusalem, and he has one article in there, and he said that he had seen pictures of what the Nazis did for entertainment in the concentration camps. And you see pictures of them laughing and smiling, playing music, and we all know what was going on in the rest of the camp, but it made no difference to them. They went on with their daily lives, because people who are that evil, it doesn't even affect them in any way. They're so desensitized to murder, and whether it's because they held so lowly of the Jews, or it's because they were so corrupt and evil inside, whatever it was, but they're able to have a good time and entertain themselves in these camps. It's disgusting in our minds. It's totally disgusting. We see the same exact thing here. Haman and Ahasuerus decree genocide, and they go out to dinner together, sit down and have a beer. That's what they do. They don't even think twice. That's what they're so numb to their actions. There's just to contrast it, there's a halacha when it comes to a Jewish court, a Beis Din. The Beis Din did give out capital punishment. But the Mishnah tells us that when they were judging a capital case, they weren't allowed to drink any wine when they were deciding the case. And they would even have to eat, you know, just in small portions. They couldn't sit down for a big meal.
And who was that again?
The Jewish courts. When the Sanhedrin or one of the Jewish courts wanted to judge a capital case, so they were supposed to decrease in eating. So they would eat just enough to have strength to judge the case. And they weren't allowed to drink any wine at all. That's a halacha. It was forbidden. And after they actually executed somebody, they'd fast the entire day. Because this is a heavy thing. Killing a person, even if it's part of Jewish law, and God says a person is liable to capital punishment, but you can't take it lightly. Don't become desensitized to it. So when you're signing the case, it's a very severe and serene moment. And after the execution, Don't go out to dinner. You know, you have to be fast for the day. You have to make sure you did the right thing. You have to think about the person who was killed, because it's a major, major thing. These wicked people, so they decree genocide, and they go out for dinner. That's what they do. That's a major contrast. But in halacha, a Beis Din, when they execute a defendant, so for the entire day, they have to fast the following day.
The saying here is the city of Shushan was
perplexed. Yeah.
Shushan the castle, can you just define that again for me, please?
Okay, so again, the translation loses a lot. The Hebrew term is Shushan HaBira. The word Bira is subject to dispute what it means. Bira may mean the capital city. Bira may mean a fortress, or Bira may mean the actual palace.
So the people, they're all Gentiles, right? They don't understand the joy?
Yeah, right. So the people in Shushan the castle were, I mean, it's mostly Gentiles. I mean, Mordechai probably was around there also.
So they understand the human condition. They understand they shouldn't be thrilled that there's this decree against the Jews.
The people that know, did they? Only the higher ups.
Well, Shushan the castle. Jews point out Shushan the castle. People who were actually in the palace, they were aware of what was happening.
And they,
Haman and the king, they sat down for a beer. Right,
and
probably,
people in the
wine.
Castle don't understand why they sat down for a beer. Because they realize this.
Well, people in this. Let's clarify. Yeah, there's a city called Shushan.
Okay.
And that surrounds Shushan HaBira.
Okay.
Shushan HaBira was, let's call it, the you know, the royal fortress in the middle of the
city.
So the people within Shushan, in the castle area, I assume they're aware of what took place.
Okay.
They didn't sit down to party with Haman and the king, but they're aware of what happened. They weren't confused. The people in the city of Shushan, they just got these letters that said, be ready for that day. So they were confused. They weren't sure what was happening. But the people, I assume the people who actually were in the palace area, I'm sure, I assume they knew what happened, but they didn't sit down to party like Haman and Achashverosh did. That's the difference.
Okay, thank you.
We'll stop here for the
Thank you.